I'm glad to join you again. And I feel like I got the sad job of, the happy job of bringing the whole thing to a close, but the sad job of teaching about death. So the two classes that I'll be sharing with you are about death, end of life issues, mourning, because I guess this is the life cycle slot, right? So what I learned from one rabbi is that the rabbi's job is to hatch, match, and dispatch. So we're up to dispatch. So hatch, match, and dispatch, right? I do a lot of chavuras and a lot of speaking around town also and around the country. So I one time sent out my speaking topics to a chavura so they could choose what they wanted. And I said, you know, just like pick whatever topic you want or I can change it around. So one chavura said, well, I think we want to hear about the soul and the afterlife, what happens after we die. So that's the next stop on the bus for most of us. And I thought, that's a way to phrase it. and then another chavura, they picked that topic, but the husband wanted what happens after you die, and the wife wanted roots of conflict in the Middle East. And she said, could you combine those two topics? So I said, sure. So what I did is I did a study of the Muslim concept of the afterlife, because I already know about the Jewish concept of the afterlife, and I compared those two concepts of the afterlife and how they impact on the politics in the Middle East. So it was actually interesting to think about something that's more relevant today than it was at the time when I gave that class. Anyway, so this class is then going to be divided into two parts. So in this session, I want to talk about basically what's on this sheet, death, and ninus, which we'll say what that is, hodes, tahara, funerals, burial, stones. And then the next class will be stages of mourning and some more afterlife stuff, although we can mix it all together because the two classes are one topic, basically. So and you're free to ask questions along the way. So starting with death. So that is something that most people experience at some point in their life, right? There's, I think, only a few people that Jewish tradition says didn't die, Eliyahu, the prophet, being one of them. But I think there's only two or three. So in general, everybody dies, and then the question is, what does that mean? So what does that mean is a question only today. I mean, what does death mean? When do you draw the line of death is a question basically that is very pertinent for today because of organ donation. But in the past, the classic test was breath. So they would put a feather here or a mirror or something to see if it would fog up or if the feather would move. If it did move for enough time, and I don't think there was a halachic time, that was just a test to make sure somebody's actually dead, then the death process, the post-death process for what happens to the body starts at that point. Today we have questions about when that line is exactly, again, for organ donation purposes, and so that's where I'm just skipping ahead, that's where I put hodes here. HODES is the halachic, stands for Halachic Organ Donation Society. You can look it up on the internet, and you can get a HODES card if that's something that you're interested in. I know that in general, there is room for organ donation. In general, the room that there is for saving a life. So it's everybody check with their own rabbi, but I think maybe we don't donate some things, like maybe a cornea, or something that doesn't save a life, or we would donate things that do save a life, organs and maybe skin, things like that, that can save a burn victim. So that's where the Halachic Organ Donation Society comes in. But everybody can check with their own halachic guide for where they want to hold on that. So what happens when we die, the actual process of death? Or what happens, like what's the procedure after death? So is that a question that a lot of people have? Or not a question. Let me just ask you.
Procedure as far as
what happens,
what the spirit does, or what you do to prepare the body.
Right. So, are you more interested in the physical, the spiritual, both? Where should we go with this? Because I want to make sure I'm giving you what you want to hear.
I'd like you to spend a little time on the physical and a lot of time on the spiritual.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Okay. Great. Okay. Physical. Die. Call Feldman mortuaries, right? Somebody's doing that for you. They come and they take, I mean, if you've designated that you want, and this is something that's worthwhile for people to do, have a conversation and say what you want to have happen, because otherwise people don't know. necessarily. I spoke to my husband about it because I have friends who are gay, and since they're not actually married, they had to set up everything legally so that it would work as if they were married. So they legally arranged everything down to the music they would hear in their room if they became vegetables. So I asked my husband, like, should we do something like this? He said, no. He said, I know what you want. You want everything according to Jewish law. I said, that's right. He said, okay, so that's the way we'll do it. And he said, and it doesn't matter what I want because you'll do everything according to Jewish law. I said, that's right. He said, okay, we had the conversation. So that was it. So... So what happens is the body gets, if you go with an Orthodox burial, which can be very helpful for relatives left behind, because this is a time of pain and grieving when people are often taken advantage of. So relatives left behind are taken advantage of. You should buy this coffin, you should bury them here, you should pay this extra expense, you should do this extra procedure, and people are in a state of shock and it can be very confusing. Once you say Orthodox, it cuts out all of that. Plain pine box, no nails, slightly fancier, slightly less fancy, but basically it's a plain pine box. That's what you get. And then there's a procedure that goes with it. So there's just, you know what to do once you say the word Orthodox. So I'll be telling you about the Orthodox procedure. There's other ones that you could choose from too. But basically what happens is the body gets picked up from wherever it is and taken to whatever mortuary it would be and then is ritually washed. So first it's guarded. So we have what's called shmira. And either a family member can do the guarding, the shmira, or you pay a person to do that shmira. The shmira comes from the olden days when our houses weren't as tight as they are now, and there were many more mice and rats around. So we actually, the shmira is actually guarding the body from harm, from mice and rats and other things that might want to take part in the body at this point. So somebody actually stays awake with the body the entire time until the burial to guard the body. Today, again, that's not the biggest concern, and certainly halachically, if somebody in a hospital, let's say, is put into a refrigerator to wait until relatives arrive or whatever that is, then it doesn't have to technically have that guarding because it is protected. So the guarding is for a physical protection. It's not really a mystical thing. Although, that being said, the soul of the departed does hover around the body and is there. So my understanding is that a similar pain is felt by the soul who's now severed from its body as by those who are left behind who are feeling the loss of that individual. So there is a sense of loss and there may be a sense of comfort in having somebody be with the soul during that period. So for that reason, it might be nice to guard also to have. And for that reason, also, it's nice to have somebody who knows the person guard.
So you wouldn't want to put them in the refrigerator then?
So really, I mean, you might have to for whatever reason. Let's say somebody dies on Shabbos, right? Or relatives are far and they're coming, so you're going to delay the funeral, although we often don't delay the funeral unless it's a very important relative. Because it is more painful for the soul. The soul is ready to go, and it needs the soul. The body needs to go into the ground for the soul to be able to start its process of disassociation. Mm-hmm. So the death process in halacha is in the Jewish sources is discussed as a continuum. There's the continuum of how the soul leaves the body. On the one side is described as like a hair being pulled out of a bowl of milk. So that's just a very easy process of soul leaving body. The other end of the continuum is like a seed being pulled out of cotton. So I don't know if you've ever had a wad of real cotton from the field and tried to pull out the seed, but it's very difficult. You have to pull really hard to get that seed out. So that's considered the continuum, an easy slip out and a resting out that's very difficult. So
halakhically, it's not necessary then if the person was in a hospital?
The guarding?
You don't need to have
as long as they're in the hospital. Right, so like let's say somebody would need to run home, take care of something, they have kids at home, they have whatever, they have somebody else they're caring for, and the body would be able to be put in the refrigerator for a short period of time. They could and leave the, you don't have to feel that tornness between the two. But then the body is going to go from there to wherever it will have the tahara. So that's the next stage. So because the body is going to be Because the body is the home of the soul and will be cared for in a way that anticipates resurrection, the body is now going to be planted and needs to be cared for that planting. It's like planting a tulip bulb. So you plant resurrection in a way is like you plant a tulip bulb, you wait through a whole winter where you see nothing, and then in the spring a flower comes up that doesn't look anything like that bulb. But it is that bulb, just not, right? That's sort of what the resurrection is like. It is planted, the body is planted in the soil. What comes up, though, is not the body that we planted. Because the body that we planted was sick or frail or for whatever reason it died. That's not the body that is going to be resurrected, but it will be related to that body physically somehow. But exactly how is, that's God gets to decide that. But it will be related to it, and then it will be transformed immediately upon resurrection by the soul dropping into that body. So that's a whole different concept. I'm trying to think if we should talk more about that yet. Not yet. So get back to that if I don't get back to that. So the tahara is what comes next. So the body then is prepared for the burial. So there is a ritual washing.
When is the soul leave the body?
So the soul leaves the body at the moment of death. You can see it happening. I just actually had a friend who died.
You can see it.
And you can see it very clearly, very clearly. It's really amazing, actually, to see, to watch the process. It was interesting to see the whole process. My friend Ari, Orlando O'Leary, if anybody knows him. So I was in the hospital with him for about 10 days, watching the death process. He had a massive stroke and then couldn't swallow anymore. And so refused nutrition that way. And so then, right, so they do take time to die. So first there was the shutting down, but then really there's a death process. When you're watching somebody die for 5 hours, that's called gosais. That stage is called gosais. And it's samech, it's not taf, so it's not like Shabbat. Gosais is how you pronounce it. So when somebody's gosais, it means they're hovering between life and death, but really hovering right then. They're dying then, not dying like they have Alzheimer's and they're dying for 3 years. They're dying then. When somebody's gosais, we're not allowed to touch them because touching helps bring the soul back into contact with the body. And at that point, once they're gosais, we let them go. So we don't want to do anything that will disturb them from the separation process because the separation process isn't easy. It's like a birth. Right? So birth coming in and separating, coming in from that world and being channeled through and coming in is a traumatic process and sometimes more and sometimes less. But the death is also a process of transition and can be traumatic, for the person depending on what they need to experience and depending on where they are on that spectrum. And every aspect of the death throes and the death process is all tightly woven into the person's need for whatever level of kapara they need, whatever atonements they need. And the whole death process is seen as part of the atonement for the life that they led. And we consider it's much better. Everybody needs some kind of atonement. We've all done stuff. However much stuff, but we've all done something. So there are really three ways to atone for negativity, three ways to cast off or unweave the negativity that we've woven into ourselves. One is tshuva. That's the proactive way that we can do ourselves, take stock of ourselves and transform ourselves. The second one is suffering. And not all suffering is this, but a way of atonement is suffering. And the third one is Gehenna, suffering after death or a process after death. Gehenna, after death, is likened unto a hospital for surgery. Nobody wants surgery. But everybody's thankful if they have a tumor to be able to check into a hospital, have their bodies cut open, have a piece hacked out, be sewn back up, and recover in pain. And they look at the doctor afterwards and say, thank you. Right? If they understand that what's happened was a part of them that needed to go was taken out. That's what Gehenna is. It's not pleasant, but it is productive. And negativity is a creation, really. Evil and bad and negativity are all something that was created in order to give us free will. So it's not something that can live forever. Good is intrinsic. Good lasts forever. And only the good part of us can last forever. So before we go on to forever, we have to first purge the negativity out of us. So those are the three ways to do it. Right now, proactively, while you're fully awake, tshuva, or suffering, different types of suffering that we have in our life, or Gehenna afterwards. The death process is part of that process. And any amount of suffering that we could have here is much easier, apparently, than what we would have on the other side. So if we would understand it, we'd almost welcome it. But at least we don't try to prevent it, especially during death, which doesn't mean we don't give morphine when somebody's in a dying process or something like that. But it does mean that we don't try to stop them from dying. We don't try to, and we don't help them die faster. We don't try to cut the dying process, shorten the dying process for them by like ODing them on morphine or any, I mean, we don't have euthanasia. We don't believe in that either. Or suicide when somebody's terminal, not that either, because the death process, although it can be very uncomfortable and can take some time, is an important process in a person's life. So after the actual death, for the person who is one of the seven relatives that mourns, and those seven relatives are mother, father, sister, brother, husband, wife, wait a second, or a child, right, spouse. Spouse is one, right? Yeah, so mother, father, sister, brother, son, daughter, spouse. Those are the seven. I just counted six, but seven. I mean, I showed you six, but seven.
But going back to the suffering, so you can't help give somebody something for pain?
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. You can. But you don't shorten their life to alleviate the suffering. You can for sure give them morphine or whatever they need and make them comfortable during the process. But you don't, let's say, withhold nutrition to make them die faster. Okay. So it's
and
one
you
thing.
You wouldn't intentionally give someone too much morphine so that they died, but you could give
right.
them if they were.
You can give
really
them what they need. Absolutely, you can give them what they need, but you shouldn't like starve yourself because you know you're going to die, or say, you know what, this person is already not feeling enough. We're just going to give them morphine and no food when they could have food, right? Like when they could swallow or they could. So you don't withhold in order to help them die. We don't hasten the death process at all.
And do we help to keep them alive?
And we do help to keep them alive. So then the question is, at what point, where is the line? Mm-hmm. So, and I'm not equipped to answer all those questions. Those questions need to be asked at the time, and they should be asked before, if possible, if somebody's in a serious state, you should ask questions. What are the lines, and how will I know to proceed as this person's loved one by their side? If they're in cardiac arrest, do we have to resuscitate? Don't we have to resuscitate? If they get pneumonia, do we have to give antibiotics? Can we not give antibiotics? If they're in stage 4 cancer, do we have to give chemo? Can we withhold chemo? Like, and is it withholding? Do they have to go through chemo? Can they not? There's different times when you can choose and when you can't choose. So, halachically. So, you know, somebody who's relatively healthy who just says, you know, I have cancer, but I don't feel like losing my hair, so I refuse chemo. I'm just going to let it. I know somebody who that happened to. She loved her hair, and so she refused chemo, and she died. You know, just because she didn't want to lose her hair. So that wouldn't be a decision that really halachically one could make for themselves. But in the end, when chemo is like, is it going to help or not, you don't have to necessarily put yourself through something that's pretty much not going to work. But those are all questions to ask of a Rav at that time. But you would want to know and clarify if you're in a situation like this, in a caretaking situation, when do you add life support? Because taking it away is much more difficult. Halachically, than not giving it. So I don't know all of those things, but that would be something to learn about if you're in that place. So now the loved one that's left behind is in the, and we're only going to talk about this state of mourning because it's right now, in a state of mourning called aninus or aninut. And that's the first stage that's before they're actually a mourner. They're in that stage, and that's the initial ripping away stage. And it's interesting that actually the soul and the mourner are in similar stages of pain and mourning and recovery from it throughout the year, which we'll talk about more next week. But this first stage is called aninus. So in that stage, before it lasts until the body is buried. In that stage, the person who's left behind, the mourner, can't do any positive commandments. So they're not allowed to transgress. They can't eat a cheeseburger, but their kosher hamburger that they're eating, they're not allowed to wash their hands and make a bracha or bench afterwards. They just eat it without saying anything. They're not allowed to learn Torah. They're not allowed to talk Torah. They're not allowed to put on tefillin, talis, daven, nothing. No positive commandments at all. Part of that is because the person's in such an empty place, but part of that is because of the departed soul. Because the departed soul is still so close, except for they realize they can no longer do mitzvahs now, that it causes them pain to see mitzvahs done in front of them. Because now they understand the importance of a mitzvah and how precious an opportunity it is. And to have it like rubbed in their face, so to speak, as a soul, is not something that we do.
So you're saying the soul can look down or view and see what's happening.
Right. The soul is right there at that point. The soul has stages of disengagement from the world. But that initial stage, before it's buried, it's still hovering very close, and the pain for it is very sharp. The disengagement pain is very sharp. The loss, that feeling of loss that somebody feels. I mean, I'm sure most of us have lost somebody in this room, so that sense of loss that we have is similar to the soul's feeling, because they're losing the world, and they're losing their loved ones. Even they're going to a good place, and they know that still it's a period of transition, and they know there's no phoning home at this point, and I miss you desperately. So they are in a sense of loss and a sense of bewilderment. It's a brand new stage. It's a whole new world. So initially there's desire to come back, or at least that strong loss of where you were. So for that reason as well, we don't do positive commandments in their presence. So the mourner doesn't, but other people don't either. So if you would be in a room where somebody just died and you need to take a drink and you're going to say a blessing, so you step out of the room. So you wouldn't do that in front of the dead body, in front of the mace or the mate. The dead body is called a mate or a mace. In general, the first thing that we do when the body dies is we do try to hold the mouth closed and close the eyes just out of respect for the body so that the body shouldn't look weird. It will feel uncomfortable looking weird. We do have some understanding that the body still has some feelings, even though the soul's not in it. And so there is a sense of shame that it can feel, and so we treat it with respect. We don't undress it or uncover it or treat it rudely or say anything in front of it that's disrespectful. Because there is still a sense there. And even in the tahara process, even when the body is ritually washed in preparation for burial, it's only uncovered one limb at a time. It's never like you don't just take the sheet off the naked body and prepare it and then clothe it. You uncover one limb at a time to wash it and prepare it. So the tahara process is first a washing, where each limb is washed. The nails are cleaned, the hair is rinsed and combed. Anything that was in the body at the time of death has to be buried with the body, except feces, which often comes out right after death. That doesn't get buried with the body. But any blood, let's say it died on the operating table or in a car accident. So any blood that comes out after death has to be buried with the body. So the sponges would be collected or the car seat would be cut out. Or, for instance, more common is hair. When you're combing the hair of the dead body, some hairs come out. You carefully collect each one of those hairs because now they're part of the dead body and they get buried with the body. So the body is carefully washed, and then, depending on the place where it's prepared, there's it either gets mikvah immersion or 9 kabim of water, about 9 buckets of water, are poured over it. That would be the only time when it's naked all the way, where you tip the table up most of the way, and then you pour 9 buckets in a row over it. So that is a second best to a mikvah, is that kind of pouring. So, and then lowered back down, padded dry, covered, padded dry section by section. Then there is some mystical things that happen. Vinegar and egg are mixed together and put on the hands and I think on the forehead. I only did one tahara, so I don't remember exactly all of the parts. But and then it's clothed in the shrouds. The shrouds are the same for men and for women. There are pants and a shirt and a hood and a veil, face veil. And the pants, I think, aren't open at the bottom, so the feet are not exposed. And I can't remember about the hands, if they're exposed or not. And then there's ties that go around the knees and around the hands and around the stomach, I think. And the ties are tied not in knots, but in a special shin shape. There's a whole mystical formula for how it's all done. And there's no talking permitted by the people who do it. Women do it for women, and men do it for men. They don't talk amongst themselves except something they have to have, like, please pass me that. But that's it. There is no other conversation at all in the presence of the body.
Do this if someone doesn't say, this is what I'm doing, this is how I'm doing.
Before you go in the room, they say, this is what we're going to do. Follow my lead. Don't say anything. And then they'll just point. It's kind of like after you wash your hands for bread, like you know how to do that kind of talking. You know, like.
If you have to bury them with the blood and all that, then when you wash them, doesn't that...
You save all those, the whatever cloths you would wash them with. You would save it and put that in the coffin. So then they're prepared, and then there's a whole forgiveness prayer, forgiveness request that's said by the people who prepared the body to the body. Please forgive us for any indignities that we did. We had to wash you, and we're sorry, and we know it was embarrassing, and please forgive us. We tried to have respect, but we know that it's not possible to respect you completely in this state, so please forgive us for any infringement of your dignity. And then placed in the coffin is closed, and then the people who did the tahara leave, and the guard stays, whoever's guarding the body. And the whoever's guarding the body usually says Tehillim, Psalms, throughout the night, because it's often over a night, but not always. Sometimes it can be you could bury a body the same day. We do feel that, Jewishly, that we should bury as quickly as possible. So if it's possible to bury the same day, that's better. And it is considered in general that it's better to bury fast than it is to wait for relatives. So unless it's a spouse or a child who is very close, not even any child, the child who is like a beloved child of this person, where you just would know that that person would want that person there, for sure, then we might wait. But not even long. If somebody can't make it, or if they're flying from across the world, they often just miss the funeral. It's very important to bury quickly. So it's considered a respect for the, not just for the body, but for the pain of the soul, because it ends that stage of pain. Right, it ends that stage of pain. So we do try to do it very quickly. In Jerusalem, they bury the same day, I mean right away, like within a few hours, because Jerusalem, the holy city, you don't want to have a dead body there overnight. Now, a dead body is considered the most tamei thing that there is, and a dead Jewish body even more than a dead non-Jewish body. Tamei, you've probably heard the words of Tuma and Tahara, or Tame and Tahor. So the concept of Tuma has to do with death. Anything that has to do with anywhere on the continuum of death, from scratching your head and getting dead skin cells in your fingernails, is a tiny little bit of Tuma. You need to wash your hands before you daven. Right? To touching a dead body, that's Tumat Mate. That's the Tuma that we all have actually now, because we have all been in hospitals or gone to funerals or were born under the same roof as a dead body in a hospital, even if there's a mortuary in the hospital somewhere, a morgue makes us tamei mate. So we all have that, and the only way that we can get rid of tumat mate is through the red heifer ceremony, which we can't do today, requires a temple. So we all have that status. Nevertheless, we still know what the categories of different levels of tuma are. So tuma really is a potential vacuum, or a vacuum of potential, which is why, ethnocentrically, a Jewish body is more tamei than a non-Jewish body, because a Jewish soul has a different spiritual capacity than a non-Jewish soul. Most of us don't necessarily realize our capacities, whether we're Jews or non-Jews. We all operate in pretty low levels of potential. Not that we don't have. We fulfill relatively low levels of our potential. So it's hard to tell the difference as we're walking around today. But the truth is that a Jewish soul has more spiritual potential than a non-Jewish soul. So they are more tamei at death than a non-Jew. So that doesn't matter to most of us, except for if you're Kohen, it does matter. So, and I don't know all the laws for Kohanim, but it does matter for Kohanim. There are practical differences. If a Kohen can come in touch with non-Jew or be in a hospital. If a dead non-Jew or dead Jew, it's different levels. Okay, so now the tahara process is done, and we have the bodies being guarded, and then the funeral arrangements are made. So the funeral in the Orthodox circles are basically, they're often graveside, not always. They could be in any kind of a place, a synagogue, a hall, anywhere, where usually eulogies are said. Eulogies are not said on Rosh Chodesh, on holidays, on Chol Hamoed, during the month of Nisan. But apart from that, eulogies are said. So sometimes during those days when eulogies are not permitted to be said, it's very difficult sometimes to bury somebody without eulogizing them. So often what people will say is, today's Rosh Chodesh, we're not permitted to eulogize. But if it weren't Rosh Chodesh and people were eulogizing, what they might say would be. And then they say that. So
when you say, because you were saying before that if they're in the hospital, you don't have to stay with the body, you don't have to watch it. But now after the tahara?
After the tahara, they're not in the hospital anymore. They're not in a closed box. They're in the funeral home. They're in the coffin.
So then you do need
shmirah. Yeah. And you can hire that or you can be that.
So that doesn't, it's
or
not preferable to have a relative then, or
right.
a friend then it can be.
Right, so either a relative or a friend, or and people take shifts too. You could, like, let's say you're a family that has enough people in it, you could do 2-hour shifts. Or if you have a teenager that doesn't really mind, they could stay up all night, depending on, body rhythms of people. But then it is, you need it, yeah, then it is, yeah. So, right, so people volunteer, and then there's also paid people who do it. You know, just people who, they get extra income by sitting Shmira for people.
Such as Ari.
Ari did. He did it for free, he did it for pay. And it was interesting because he often would say, and I mentioned some name of some old Denverite, and he'd say, oh, I remember Molly, I sat Shmira for her. And that was the connection that he had, you know, that he communed with the soul at that time. So that would be something loving that he did. And sometimes it was for pay and sometimes not. So then the eulogies are said. Funerals, unlike everything else in Judaism, start on time. It's like the only thing. I don't know how we got this, but when it says 3, they start at 3. And if you show up at 3:15, you missed it. So funerals start on time. So that's the one thing to plan for if you're going to a funeral. Arrive early, park in time to be able to walk there. Whatever it is, they usually start on time. So, and they're usually not very long. For a younger person, they might be longer. Or for a rabbi or somebody who is more renowned, they might be longer. But usually it's 15 minutes, 30 minutes, and that's it. And then there's the burial. So if the ceremony was in another building, so then if the body was in the building, then the mourners would, the family follows the casket out of the building to the hearse. Then the family gets in their cars behind the hearse and everybody else goes behind them. And then you drive to the cemetery and then the family would walk with the body and other people walk. So there is a concept to walk with the dead, to guide the dead to their burial place. It's called halva'at hamet, levayat hamet. And that's why a funeral is called a levaya, a guiding, a walking with. It's the same word, that root is the same word as melava malka. Milave from Levaya to guide the queen out after Shabbos. We take her out. Milava Malka. So, but Levaya is the same root word. So, to walk with the dead. So people do that. And then, the casket is lowered into the ground. Usually in this country, it's in a wooden box. In Israel, it's often just in a talus, wrapped in a talus, or, I don't know if women are wrapped in a talus too. If they're not buried in a box, I'm not sure of that question.
Here
it's required to have a box, right? Right, and we're permitted to follow the laws of the state. If it's required, some states require a concrete box too, especially states that have high water tables.
In Florida,
for instance. So one is permitted to follow the laws of the state. One wouldn't have to, let's say, take their dead and bury them in a state that doesn't require that. You could bury in Florida.
New Orleans,
right? Places with high water tables, they require concrete or above the ground burial, so which we prefer below. So then the box is lowered, and then our tradition is we do the burying. So not the cemetery.
Years ago, what they used to do is tuck the cover off the box. So they buried a person to hit the person.
Yes,
that was 25 years ago.
I hear. I think probably that might still exist in some places, because certainly in Israel, they bury without a box at all, or they bury with a box that you can pull out the bottom so that the body's resting right on the ground.
I don't remember that.
So in Israel, but here, so I don't know, different places do different customs, and different cemeteries have different customs. By the way, Jewish cemeteries, if they're Orthodox cemeteries, sometimes require proof of Jewishness for burial there. So in case anybody's a convert, you might just want to, like I did, file your certificate with somebody who knows so that there wouldn't be a question if there was a question, if the need arises. But it's just something to think about. Some places don't check and some places do. I do not understand, so I can't explain. And it's just a question I have. Why do we bury separately? Other faiths do it too, and I just don't understand why. So it's a question that remains. If anybody knows, you could let me know. But I just don't understand why we, if the idea is to plant somebody in the ground, why does it need to be separate ground? And some cemeteries separate by Catholics and Jews, Shomer Shabbos and non-Shomer Shabbos. So Catholics and Jews, Christians and Jews, Jews and other people, separate. In the Christian world, too, Catholics and Protestants, separate. In the Protestant world, Missouri Synod and Lutheran Synod, separate. You know, like this.
Actually, in Judaism, you're supposed to try to make sure that your plot, if you're next to a man, it should be a man who's a relative. An unknown man should not be on the plot next to you.
Right, so I do not know why. There is that, but there is such a thing. And in Israel, the cemeteries are gender separate altogether.
Oh, really? So you're not married?
And even in Jewish, it's broken down from Shomer Shabbos.
And Shomer Shabbos, not Shomer Shabbos. I was spoken, and often in, and Kohanim are usually buried on the edge, so that their relic, because a Kohen can't go into a cemetery. So if a Kohen wants to visit a grave, they can't go into the cemetery to visit. So they often bury the Kohanim on the edge, so the Kohen can just go to the edge of the cemetery and see their relatives' graves. So I spoke to Mrs. Kahan, Rabbi Kahan's mother. Rabbi Kahan on the West Side's mother. She's Belgian. So she told me, she didn't want to say any words, but she said, I was talking to the holy people, that's the Chevra Kedisha, about where I would like to be near my husband, because her husband passed away already. She said, and I said, I would like to be there. And they said, Madame Kahan, this is with the Freie Yidden. And she said, so this is with the non-religious Jews. And she said to them, I don't think one of them is smoking on Shabbos. they said, Madame Kahan, you have to be buried with the Shomer Shabbos. So she said, maybe I could do Kiruv. Kiruv is drawing non-religious Jews closer to religion. So she figured if she's buried in the non-religious place, maybe. That was so funny. She had that sense of humor, right? So that's what she said. I don't think one is smoking on Shabbos, and maybe I could do Kiruv. So, but anyway, they told her she can't go there. So I don't understand that. I don't know where the differences are and why that is, and I don't know if that's related to sensitivities for the living or if there's really something there for the dead, and I don't know if it's true or not, but Ari Leary told me that in Golden Hill, they buried the healthy separately from the sick, because the sick were down the hill.
A lot of the sick ones are up on the hill.
Right, that's what he said, the
and
sick ones are up the hill.
Don't have gravestones because they were poor, so they have little plaques.
Mm-hmm. So healthy, sick, you're burying separately? Right.
Most of the ones up on the hill are from the JC.
Right, so that's what he said. The ones that had TB, the sick ones, are buried up the hill. And the healthy ones buried down the hill. All right, that's what I'm saying. The healthy buried, really. The healthy separate from the sick.
It must be all for the living. This craziness.
Right. Right. Right, that's right. Only sick people are burying healthy people. Exactly, good. So, right, that was the joke about President Clinton when he was in the presidency and Air Force One crashed into some cornfield and they send the Secret Service out there right away and they're like, oh no, did you, look, they ask the farmer there, he's just puttering along with his tractor and they say, did you see like an airplane and like it crashed? And he said, oh yeah, it crashed. He said, I buried all of them. They said, all of them? They all died? Even the president? President Clinton died? He said, I buried all of them. And he said, and the president, he kept saying he wasn't dead, but I know what a liar he is. Okay, so anyway. So then, after they put the casket in the ground, then our custom is that we bury ourselves. I mean, we ourselves do the burial. So we shovel. And that first shovelful, when you hear it hit the coffin, is very heart-wrenching, no question about it. And usually it's the closest relatives who start.
So don't you stay till it's done?
You stay till it's done, yeah. So we shovel, do as much as you feel like. And then our custom is not to pass the shovel, but we leave the shovel in the dirt. So shovel a few, stick it in the dirt, step back, and let somebody else step forward and pick it up. But we don't want to pass the sadness of that mitzvah to somebody else. So we let them pick up the mitzvah, but we don't pass it. So, and then we finish the shoveling. And then as people leave, the same thing. When you're leaving the cemetery, and you may go visit other graves at that point, now the funeral's over and the burial's over. But when we leave, there's a hand washing, a ritual hand washing that's done, which I'll tell you in a second. That ritual, oh, right, thank you. There's the, before we leave, thank you very much. Appreciate that. There is a procession of the mourners. The mourners line up, and all the comforters pass through them. So they line up in two rows at the end after the burial, and then all the comforters, all the guests or whatever you want to call them, friends, walk between the two rows and say, they don't stop to say it, but they say as they're walking through, Hamakom. Hamakom yinechem etchem betuch. Pardon?
The other way around.
Oh, thank you. The mourners pass through, and you say, right, because I knew it was too fast to say it, right, because they just walk through, and you can't say the whole thing. Right, thank you. Thank you. A little dyslexic there. Okay, the guests all line up. The mourners pass through, and as the mourners go through that row, all the people say, Hamakom yinechem etchem betoch shar evlei tzion v'yushalayim. So, which you can get in English or Hebrew to have as a card, but I'm sure you've heard it in English, that the, how do you say it in English? May the omnipresent comfort you among the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem.
So who's saying it? The mourners are saying it?
No, we say it to the mourners.
Yes.
This is a phrase that it pays to memorize, because you say it at every Shiva call. Right, you say it at every Shiva call, and you say it at a funeral, like this. And you always say it in the plural. I once paid a Shiva call on an only daughter. So it was, both parents were already gone. She is sitting Shiva now for her mother. So there were no other relatives. So it was a woman sitting alone, sitting Shiva by herself. So I switched it into the feminine singular. Hamakom yinechem otach b'toch shar v'leitzim v'yushalayim. And she said, oh no. She said, you still say it in the plural, because you're comforting the soul of the departed also. The soul is in the Shiva house, which is why, which we'll talk about more next time, it's best to sit Shiva in the house of the deceased, because that is where the soul hovers the most during that week, is in that house. Now, if Shiva's somewhere else, so then they have to go somewhere else. And I don't know what it means if they sit Shiva in different places. The son's in New Jersey and the daughter's in Colorado and they sit Shiva separately. But really, if possible, it's best to sit Shiva in the house of the deceased.
And what if there is no house for the deceased?
Meaning, right, they lived in a nursing home. So then you have to sit where you live. But let's say they lived in a nice room in a nursing home. My grandmother had like a little suite in her nursing home. So you could sit Shiva there. You could receive people there. Right, or if they don't want you, right, if they don't want you because it scares the other people, so then you can't do that. So then you pick up.
Say the phrase again.
Hamakom yinachem etchem Betoch Shar Evlei Tzion V'Yerushalayim. This is one of the few times that we refer to God as Hamakom, the place. Usually we use other names for God. So the place means that God is everything. There is nothing but God, except for us. So how are we here? The only reason that we're here, that the only reason we can exist, is because God, who's everything, actually contracted himself, itself, to make space for this world to exist in. Contracted itself physically and contracted God's will so that we could have free will. To create physical space and space for our will. So that contraction of Godness had to happen for us to exist, but God is everything. So at this time, when we're feeling that supreme sense of loss, like this matters so much, we remind ourselves by saying, and remind the mourner by saying, Hamakom, the one who's everything, should comfort you among the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. So we're close to the end for tonight. So stones, let's just say stones. So now, just stones in the washing. So you put a stone, when you visit a grave, we put a stone on it to say that we've been there. Part of that is that we're not non-Jews. We're not trying to paper over death. And we're not trying to make, and we bury quickly, so we don't need flowers. The non-Jewish custom of flowers is because dead bodies smell bad. So you want to have a lot of flowers to perfume the air to take away the stench of death. We bury quickly, so we don't have that problem. But B, we don't want to do what they do. So we don't bring flowers. Our funerals don't have flowers, and our graves in general don't have flowers. We put a stone. So part of it is to differentiate. But part of it is to, because stones are permanent, or as permanent as there is in this world. So it is saying, you affected me, and I can, whatever your, not that it physically represents, but your tombstone is what remains in this world of you that we can see, and it's relatively permanent looking, but you don't end here. You still grow, you still affect, you still add. I'm adding to this because you add to my life. Every time I think about you, there's something more of you that's living in this world, and I represent that by adding something on to what's left behind of you. Because something is more that's going through this. So we put stones. Sometimes when people go on trips, they'll take a stone from their trip to bring to a grave, to like kind of bring a piece of the trip to the person too. And then finally, we leave the cemetery and do that ritual washing. So the ritual washing is the same as when you wake up in the morning, because both of those have to do with the tumah of death. That initial wake up in the morning, in case you didn't know, is where you grasp the cup in your right hand, fill it up, switch it over to your left, and then pour. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pours, set it down, walk away. And we shake for this. We don't dry it on anything. You just shake dry. I'm not sure why that is either. But for the cemetery one, you shake dry and you take off your rings just like for bread. So you take off your rings for this washing, wash that way, put your rings back on, shake dry, put the cup down, not pass the cup to the person that's behind you, and leave the cemetery. No blessing for this. Okay, any questions on this? And then we'll do more metaphysical, hopefully, next week in the morning process where we're headed.
Just one question a little earlier about if the soul leaves the body, like the hair coming so easily, is there any correlation between that and spiritually if they have to go to the hospital in the afterlife?
I think there is. I think so, too. Yeah, I think so.
It's so easy of a transition.
Right. Right, so I think about it. Like sometimes I read in the IJ in this last week that a boss was in the hospital secretly a few times. So I thought to myself, he should suffer and die. And I thought, no, he shouldn't suffer. He should die quickly so that he could suffer everything he needs to suffer in the next world and not suffer here and get away with it. I'd rather have him suffer more, but because the suffering can expiate later. So it's possible that it doesn't, now that I'm thinking about that. The quick leaving can be just you've done it, especially if it was a longer death process before. But some people just leave. Some people just go to sleep, you know, and they have a headache, they go to sleep, and they're gone.
Right.
Right? So it might or might not. You don't know for sure. You don't know. No. We don't know. And we don't judge, and we don't wonder. We only think about ourselves. We never judge somebody else, even though it's very tempting. And frankly, we never judge ourselves either. We only think about ourselves. But we don't know enough about our own history and everything that went into us in past lives, too, to be able to ever judge ourselves negatively. So we try to be soft with ourselves and certainly never to judge somebody else either.
Thank you. I remember hearing something about when you were moving a body from a room, just to go out feet first or head first?
Right.
Feet first, I thought, but I was...
Mm-hmm. Is it feet first? There is a way to do that.
You can't have your head, like in your bed, the head.
It must be that's
face the door.
What?
Your feet should be toward the door.
Right, so it must.
Go out feet first.
Maybe you go out head first because we do things opposite.
Okay.
I mean, I know, for instance, when.
Go out head first.
Could be you go out head first and that's why we don't sleep with our head towards the door.
That might be.
I think that might be because we don't sleep with our head towards the door because of that. But I don't know
should
if that's.
Call about that?
I thought it was
feet. Feet toward the door, not head.
You don't.
Yeah, feet towards the door, not heads toward the door.
Your bed should be oriented so your feet are toward the door, not your head.
Right, you're not supposed to have your head towards the door. Mm-hmm.
I had right. a question on the organ donation. Mm-hmm. Donation. So if you can you have a Orthodox the tahara and all that if you are an organ donor? Then you
yes,
couldn't,
you can. You can. So that's an excellent question because as you heard, we are very careful to bury every drop of a person with the person. So it that's why we don't. We do care about the body. And we want it to be buried whole. And so we don't give things lightly. We wouldn't donate, I don't know, hair for somebody who lost hair or whatever.
So then if you were
but you donate, but you can.
Observe it, you wouldn't
but
be
saving a life.
License as an organ donor.
Probably not because that's, I think that's brain death, not heart death. And that's not considered, it's a question mark. It's not considered, there's lines in there. Yeah. About levels of death. And then they just take. Right, and then they just take what they want. There's not, and that's unfortunate because there's no way to say that you can.
I just got a new license and I had them take the organ donor symbol off for that reason.
Right, because then you don't know what they're going to take because then they can just harvest whatever they want.
When I filled out that I was an organ donor, the guy who was taking it didn't make any difference. We're not going to take your organs anyway.
Yeah.
If you die and you're an organ donor, they don't take the organ. They still have to get permission from someone. He said, so if you checking it doesn't mean when you die we take them. It means that we'll call who's ever in
mm-hmm.
charge of you and see what they uh-huh. want
to
do.
That's good. Good to know. But my, I, huh, interesting, because I thought it was for, because I know there is a time when they can't take it anymore, so I thought if there's a...
Well, yeah, they do.
Yeah, they move quickly.
Well,
yeah, I think they do move quickly.
Your heart has to stop, and so you have to kind of know.
Well, a lot of times that,
right.
You can say,
you know,
to such and such way, I
right.
this whole other
thing
that I went to.
Right.
But Israel's making a big push, and Judaism
yes.
is making a big push to be organ donors.
Right.
Because that whole thing in Israel that
right.
Jews aren't donating, Israeli Jews, Israelis aren't
right.
donating,
yeah,
and so we're taking all these organs from other people, and
it's
not really...
Right.
Do that.
Right. That's a good point. What's your name?
Mara.
Mara?
Which is why if it's not...
Mara has a good point. I mean, she's... So here, it is a problem in Israel that because Israeli medicine is so advanced, we do a lot... There are a lot of organ transplants in Israel and successful ones, but because we have these sensitivities about bodies being buried whole, a lot of Jews do not donate. So, and particularly in Israel, they have to import bodies. So it is a problem. They are trying to raise awareness. Yeah, they have to import organs, right? So they are trying to raise awareness among Israelis and among Jews that we should be donors. We can be donors. There's a halachic way to do it. So, and that being said, it's very important to understand if somebody dies in a motorcycle accident or somebody's cremated when you really didn't want them to be because the other siblings, you know, the parent said, I want to be cremated. The other siblings trumped you or whatever it is and they're cremated. Or they died in the Holocaust and they were cremated or whatever it is. Resurrection is a miracle and it can happen from anything. You don't need a whole body for that. It's just we should bury the whole body. So up to us, we should be faithful and bury the whole thing. But up to God, he can do resurrection with whatever is left. God can do it. So we just have to know it's a miracle no matter what, and that the mitzvah of saving a life trumps burying a whole body. So we should, if we can, halachically donate what we can.
I think a rabbi gave a talk on this.
Is to making it clear to somebody.
It is, yes. So it's very important.
I heard a rabbi give a talk on this recently, and he said things have changed so much in the last 20 years, and will probably change that much more in the next 20 years. Whatever you think you know is probably wrong. You better consult someone.
Right, right.
Because what they said 20 years ago is no longer true in the Orthodox.
It's true. You do need to designate a halachic answerer. That's important.
Currently, in the medical halacha books, it is. I was one of the things we have this
come with a confession. He talks about how if you're walking by a stream and you don't know how to swim, but you see someone drowning, and great danger to yourself, you require to go in and try to save that person. Even though it means a really good chance of danger to you. However, if someone, even a close family member, requires a blood transfusion or something like a liver transplant, which would grow back on you or whatever, you are not required in any way to give that, even though your chance of survival, whatever, would be 99%. You're not required to do any of that.
No, what it says, it's more than that. It says in the Talmud, if you are given a choice, you can save someone's life by giving a finger, you're not required to do it. There's a long discussion in the Talmud. This is one finger. You're not required.
Interesting.
You can do it. You're not forbidden. But you're not required to do it.
It's a great risk to your life. You
right.
are required.
Well, there is a difference between immediate danger and long-term danger also. So a kidney transplant isn't like death that second, whereas drowning is death that second.
Death in the next few days.
So I don't, yeah. So we do fortunately have people who are experts in this type of law, and we should consult them.